Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, Illinois is a leader in trying to address what is known as period poverty. We'll hear from one woman who has taken on the issue at her university. There's a controversy involving some high school students' dress codes, why some say they are discriminatory to young women. Also, we'll examine Illinois' overhaul of school funding from a few years ago. How are things working out for those schools who need the additional help the most? And a once dominant name in American business, Sears, formerly the nation's largest retailer, has long ties to Illinois, but it's about to close its lone remaining store in the state, located in a Chicago area mall.
It used to be a flagship store, if I recall right, so it's unfortunate to see this happening to these stores.
We'll look back at the rise and fall of Sears. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, we'll hear about school dress codes, why some students say they're unfair. Period poverty is a real problem. There are some new laws in Illinois to address it. And Sears' final store in Illinois is about to close. We'll hear about the history of the retailer in Illinois. That and more coming up on Statewide. Well, it was 4 years ago, Illinois overhauled the way the state funds K-12 education. Peter Medlin has more on how much it's actually changed for the schools that need the money the most.
Illinois used to have the most unfair education funding in the nation. That was according to a 2015 study from the Education Trust, a nonprofit that advocates for students. It found low-income schools received significantly less aid than they would in other states. In DeKalb, 60% of students are designated as low income, which is much higher than the state average of 48.5%. Cindy Carpenter is the DeKalb School District's Director of Business and Finance, and she says the old system wasn't equitable, and even worse, the state didn't put much money into it.
Each year they would be like, well, you know, we just don't have enough money to fund it. We're going to say, well, you should get $20 million, but, you know, we can only give you 85% of that.
Carmen Ayala was the superintendent of the North Berwyn School District and served on a state coalition pushing the legislature to create a new funding model. Now she's the state superintendent. She says Illinois used to wait well into the summer to pay districts, which made it really hard to plan.
You know, a lot of districts make their staffing decisions January, February, March. We used to have this big unknown and really couldn't add staff.
In 2017, the state enacted the evidence-based funding formula. It looks at dozens of factors like the number of English language learners and special education teachers to come up with an adequacy target of how much the state believes a school should spend. Schools the furthest from their target are prioritized to receive the most state funding. Ayala says the new formula helped her district get new technology as well as reading and bilingual specialists. Carpenter agrees it's made staffing easier, which helps when staffing makes up the vast majority of a school budget. The districts that don't have nearly enough local tax revenue coming in, like DeKalb, are known as Tier 1. Cindy Carpenter says they could feel the difference right away in the first year of evidence-based funding.
We received an additional $2.8 million because of that Tier 1 status.
Ayala says the goal was to get every school district up to at least 90% adequacy in a decade. But like the old way, the formula needs money to work.
We're not there yet. And so we still have about 8 out of 10 students are still in districts that have not reached the 90% adequacy. In order to get to that target, we need to invest about $900 million in that extra tier money.
Illinois lawmakers promised to increase education spending by $350 million a year. The pandemic threw many wrenches into many well-laid plans, and education wasn't immune. In 2020, education spending wasn't cut like some feared, but held flat. With a new formula, it doesn't mean there aren't still inequities. Because local tax dollars still reign supreme in education funding, some districts in the same county are light years apart in funding. Just in Ogle County alone, one district is at 68% of adequacy, while another soars over 120%. Low-income, Black, and English learning students still see the largest funding gaps. That doesn't mean progress isn't being made. When the funding formula started, Illinois had over 150 school districts below 60% of their adequacy target. Today, there are just 16. Most Illinois students go to a school, like DeKalb, that's between 60 and 70%. Cindy Carpenter says DeKalb is in a much better place financially because of evidence-based funding, especially the hold harmless provision, which means they'll never get less money than they received the year before. The district's fund balance is about $50 million now, which gives them the flexibility to hire more teachers, decrease class sizes, and even offer abatements to try and bring down local tax bills.
I think it's a great model. The main thing we're always very concerned about, are they going to continue to fund it so we can all get to that 100% adequacy mark?
5 years after helping it pass, current Illinois Superintendent Carmen Ayala is also now the head of a state review panel assessing the overall impact of evidence-based funding. The group will be providing a report next year. I'm Peter Medlin.
For many of the high school students who have headed back to the classroom this fall, it's meant exchanging sweatpants for regular clothes. And for some, it's meant being told what not to wear. That's angering a lot of students, especially young women. Adriana Cardona-McGeegan has this story from Chicago.
Short shorts, spaghetti strap tank tops, mini skirts, that's what some high school students have been wearing over the past few weeks. Outside Jones College Prep High School during dismissal, students Mila and Isabel described their outfits.
I am wearing a skirt, but I turned it into a dress. Earlier in the week, I did also just wear a bra one day, and then the next day I wore a corset with a very short skirt. I would be wearing crop tops. That for sure showed my stomach, that showed a lot of my cleavage.
It's still hot outside, and some students want to dress comfortably. But as they show up to class in threads of their choice, they're confronting school dress codes. Each Chicago public school can set its own dress code, and several have banned certain clothes, like crop tops and short shorts. Others are more general and ask students to dress appropriately. This has caused controversy at several schools, including the Chicago High School for the Arts and Lincoln Park High School. Outside Lincoln Park recently, some female students say they feel unfairly targeted.
I think males, sometimes they have like their pants like down and no one says anything. Sometimes they don't have shirts on, and I don't think they really get dress coded for that. They say you can't show like your chest or your midriff, but that doesn't affect anyone else, because if someone wants to wear it, they can wear it because it's their style or it's comfortable for them, and like it shouldn't affect anyone else.
Jones is one of the high schools with a general dress code that doesn't specify what's allowed and what's not. Students were shocked when their principal used the intercom recently to tell them to dress appropriately. In response, Isabel, the Jones student, put a call on social media asking their peers to wear their sexiest outfits in support.
So I posted it on my Snapchat story, and I get like a decent amount of views, especially from Jones kids. And then I also texted like everybody that I know that I've ever spoken to at Jones. And I
students at other high schools posted similar invitations on social media. Some principals say dress codes help students focus on their academics and help with discipline issues. They prevent students from wearing offensive slogans or gang colors. Some schools go as far as having uniforms, but they are tied to huge controversies around unfairly disciplining students. And while there's a pandemic going on, many principals say they have bigger issues to worry about. At Ogden International High School, the dress code is pretty simple. Principal Devin Herrick believes it works for everyone.
We have language about no inappropriate logos or slogans. And then, like I said, you know, we're trying to avoid kind of borderline nudity, obviously, in the school, as any kind of institution, right, or public space would do.
He says the code was updated recently in collaboration with students.
No, I think the key thing is really to strive to find an end product, right, that best represents the interests of the whole school community, right, while, again, you know, keeping in mind some non-negotiables and kind of doing that within reason.
Mila and Isabel say instead of being told what not to wear, they would like to see more support when students report sexual misconduct at Jones. At a recent school meeting, Jones principal Joseph Powers said his announcement using the school's intercom was simply to urge students to dress appropriately.
My announcements made the first week of school were done in the mildest possible terms, urging students to use common sense and what is considered to be appropriate dress at school.
The students say they understand overall concerns about school safety and the idea of learning how to dress appropriately, but they are upset about the lack of clarity.
If the code is just going to be use common sense, and if you are feminine presenting and we don't like what you're wearing, you're doing it wrong.
Mila and Isabel say they're open to changes in the school's dress code as long as there is student input. Adriana Cardona-Magigad, WBEC News.
Plans for the world's first carbon-neutral industrial park are gaining momentum in Putnam County. Mark Marquis is CEO of Marquis Energy, based in Hennepin. He plans to achieve carbon-neutral status on a 2,500-acre industrial site by sequestering carbon in the ground. He says most of central and southern Illinois is inundated with sandstone, uniquely suited for the purpose.
Low-carbon business is something that Illinois, given where it's located geology-wise, Illinois can be the leading state in low-carbon business going into the future and do more than its part to reverse climate change.
Marquis says the industrial park could currently store about 4 million tons of CO2 per year. Well, many colleges and universities welcome students back on campus this fall despite the ongoing pandemic. Rich Egger talked to the person at Western Illinois University who is promoting vaccinations and making sure students and staff follow COVID protocols.
Joe Roselieb is Western's Executive Director of Auxiliary Services and Risk Management. He says 85% of Western's employees and more than 50% of its students are vaccinated against the virus. Roselieb says they've come a long way with vaccinating students since the start of the semester in mid-August.
It was below the 20% when we started off, and with anything new, we've sort of had to build the program that we're using behind the scenes. And so what we've found is it isn't as simple as saying if you're physically here, you have to upload or test, or if you're not, you're omitted. There's so many anomalies that we found from students that are all online, but still on campus, all online altogether, arrange classes that don't necessarily, the computer doesn't know if that's in person or not, internships, but still living on campus, internships off campus. There's a lot of different coding that's had to take place. So we've built, I'm very confident that our percentage was higher at the time, but based on just the pure uploads as the start of the beginning of the school year, we're under that 20 percentile. So over the last several weeks, we've significantly grown in that.
So what about the 50% of students who are not vaccinated? Are you certain they're getting tested weekly?
So that's an area that we need to improve in. We have improved, but we still have a lot of to go. We continue to clean up a lot of our list. Again, it's amazing how many sort of anomalies come between someone being on campus one week and not being on another. So you have to fix that on the back end. We do mandate testing. So if they have not provided proof, they have to test weekly. And we're seeing several hundred go through each day, which is significantly more than even last year. We've grown leaps and bounds compared to last year, several hundred a day. But for weekly, we've still got several hundred that are non-compliant and that we're working on different ways to try to get them to comply with that.
And what might those be?
So we've taken sort of a progressive disciplinary approach. The first couple of weeks were disciplinary letters saying you need to do this. That, of course, every time we do something like that, it yields more. We've now moved into, we've suspended recreation center access. We've looked at taking away, if you're not compliant, if you participate on a club team or an organizational team, you will not be allowed to travel. So we're just getting all, it's a combination between using technology and using sort of the old pen and paper method and working with advisors and club organizations and presidents to get them updated lists, timely lists, pure lists or clean, up-to-date lists, all of that sort of what we're working through. We're also working with our Student Rights and Responsibilities Office for their intervention when that time comes. We've talked about dismissal and we continue to discuss that. That's obviously the last case scenario or what we don't want to do. With that many students, it just isn't realistic.
What about faculty members who are not vaccinated? Are they all getting tested?
Yeah, so right now, our non-compliance for faculty, I said several hundred for students, it's below 50 for our employees. So a little easier to look at that population and talk to some. But we've had a couple that, you know, that's fallen on us that we, after talking through, they're adjunct, so they're not physically here. So we clean up those lists. So that number continues to dwindle down. But employee-wise, you know, everyone's, for the most part, has been compliant. We'll continue to work on those individuals. HR, Human Resources, has their process that they're working through, including suspension without pay, days off without pay. They're working through that, and sort of that baton sort of been handed off to them to facilitate that process now that it's more manageable. But, you know, I think if something you say, what are you happy about? I really appreciate the employees setting that example for our students, and it's gone a long ways. It's allowed us to, we knew we were going to have to deal with some, but it's really allowed us to concentrate on that student population and not have to deal with the employee side, because and every day I'm getting more and more people that are uploading. So it's going very well in the employment aspect.
And I asked about faculty, but actually you're talking all employees on Western, full-time employees.
Correct. If they're physically on our campus, even if you're an adjunct, not full-time, but an adjunct professor, that you're physically on our campus, you're considered part of that population. So, yeah, and we haven't broken off between faculty or staff, or it's employees. It's all cumulative.
Joe Roselieb is Executive Director of Auxiliary Services and Risk Management at Western Illinois University. He says he does not know the exact number of students and employees who become ill with COVID-19 this semester, but he says the number is quite low. Roselieb says the administration continues to monitor the situation as aggressively as it did in week one. He says, as we've seen throughout the pandemic, things can change quickly. Rich Egger reporting.
A well-known steam-powered paddle boat that was a familiar sight along the Illinois River is up for sale. The Julia Bell Swain is now docked in Wisconsin after a restoration effort ended. The boat's for sale for just under $1 million. It's believed to need about $1 million in additional work. The Julia Bell Swain was built 50 years ago. It made appearances in the films Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. Well, there's more to come here on Statewide. Stay with us.
When the Julia Bell comes to Peoria, you know that summer's here, and up on the Illinois River, that's the very best time of the year. Those steamboat days in August, like a hazy, lazy dream. I want to be at the foot of Main Street when the Julia Bell raises steam. When the Julia Bell raises steam.
This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, Sears is getting ready to shutter its final location in Illinois. It's the last chapter in the story for the once largest retailer and the state. 1 in 10 college students say they struggle to afford menstrual products each month. It's called period poverty. Well, this summer, Governor J.B. Pritzker signed a package of legislation to address the problem, and one requires state universities and community colleges to provide free menstrual hygiene products in campus restrooms. He signed that legislation at a fitting place, Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. SIUE has what is known as the MINSEE Project. Sarah Finsky talked with the person who started it, instructor Christy Ferguson.
So, Christy, your interest in this issue all started in 2017. What happened to you then?
Well, many years ago, I had been diagnosed with PCOS. And for anyone who has ever known about that, that particular issue, it's polycystic ovary syndrome, which means I've had a whole lot of issues. Mm. And eventually, I finally was able to get a doctor to hear me and my fear of a cancer scare. And when they finally realized that there was a problem, they finally gave me the go-ahead to get the hysterectomy. So when I got my hysterectomy, I came back to campus in January and I had an entire drawer full of these products and a bunch at home. And I just remember thinking, you know, what am I going to do with these now? And I thought, you know what, let's just put them in the bathroom. Let's just put them in the bathroom and give them to somebody. So I made just little makeshift bags out of Ziploc bags that day and put them in the bathrooms in my building. And from there, it just exploded. People were so excited. You know, I just started making the bags and putting them up, and ever since then, it's just been this really wonderful, you know, ongoing program that has helped people have access to the materials that they need during this time in their life.
So any woman could tell you, these are not cheap. I mean, when you're going around playing Santa Claus, putting these around on campus, there's got to be a substantial cost with that.
No, they're not cheap. And that's a big part of the problem because they have been heavily taxed. And they, you know, I mean, even the lower end brands, you know, we're talking $5 to $10 a box for these products. So I actually ran it on donations. I had, you know, donations from faculty and staff on campus and from people in the community. And I had student organizations step up and gather donations multiple times a year. And all of our product bags that I make, I actually make them by hand. I'm an artist and a craftivist, so I tend to bring my art in to anything that I'm doing activism-wise. And so I just started making the bags and putting them all over the place. And that all those materials were donated from the Macoupin Art Collective in Staunton, Illinois, which is a tiny little nonprofit art school. It's been wonderful. We haven't really had to spend anything because people have been so ready and willing to help.
Wow. I mean, this is just amazing to hear about. And is it the case then that the campus no longer even has vending machines? They're just counting on these free products?
So the vending machines, the for tampons and pads, came out of the majority of the bathrooms many years ago. I think that I was still an undergrad. It's been a long time. What happened was that they took them out of every bathroom except for the one bathroom, the one women's bathroom on the first floor of each building. And I don't know still to this day, I've gotten many stories. I don't know for sure what happened or why that happened. But I remember people being really kind of frustrated and upset about it. And now I think that those machines, the ones on the first floor, still exist. But I don't know if they work or if they've been filled because ever since I put the bags up and the students have been helping me keep them filled, it's been, you know, people have just been contacting me. Hey, did you know this bag is empty? Hey, can we get some more? You know, that kind of thing. So
we actually heard from a listener. She says that when she was a student on campus, that you had to go to this first floor if you needed these supplies. So even beyond a question of money, this was a question of inconvenience. Sydney Simpson writes, yeah, she said it was inconvenient if you forgot to pack extra essentials. She adds, for many people, it isn't always easy to track or plan for emergencies revolving around this topic. The Mensi Project offered a sense of support that was otherwise lacking. It's never been a luxury to have to pay extra or wonder if items will be available. And I'm glad this project brought awareness and a necessary change for the next wave of students. And Christy, in addition to stocking women's room, I understand you've begun to stock the men's rooms as well.
Yes. Oh, we've been, so when we first started the project, we did all of the women's and family and non-gender specific bathrooms. The problem is that we don't have a lot of non-gender specific bathrooms yet. Apparently only 5 of our buildings actually have them. This is actually something that the Safe Zone and the Gay Straight Alliance on campus have proposed a bill to change that so that there's more of those on campus. But until then, you know, it's necessary for us to realize that this is not a women's issue. It's a human issue. Genders don't menstruate. Humans do. If we don't have access for our trans students as well, then we're not doing our due diligence to take care of the entire community on campus. So when, so we had originally started to talk about this, you know, at the very beginning, and then as the project built, and then COVID hit recently when I was just about to start meeting with trans students and try to see exactly what they wanted and what would be most helpful for them, then I had a hard time making those connections. So I just started doing my own research and then talking to other people who had seen these kinds of things on other campuses. And we just decided just go for it. Let's just do it and get it in the men's room too, so that everyone has access. And that's why we also changed all our signage so that it was across the board, talks about period poverty specifically, and the fact that this is a human issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, so in addition to this bill that I mentioned that now requires colleges to do what you've been doing and make these products available for free, there's two other bills that the governor signed in Illinois related to this issue. One would require the state to apply for a waiver that allows SNAP and other direct assistance funds to be used on these products. And another requires homeless shelters to stock these projects if their budget is permitting. Christy, I understand you've also worked with homeless people in St. Louis. Is there a major need for them to be able to get these kind of products?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I've worked with nonprofits quite a bit in the last, 10 years or so, 10, 15 years. And any time that I'm talking with a homeless individual who also menstruates, that's one of the first things that they ask for. That's not a new issue either. And I think that it's part of the problem with that is just that we don't talk about period health enough. We don't talk about it because we've been told not to, that it's a taboo subject, that it's private, that it's something that's, gross in many ways. And it just, the reality is that this is a part of the public health crisis, especially in connection to reproductive health.
SIUE instructor Christy Ferguson. She started the MNCE project on campus a few years ago to help address period poverty. And this year, Governor Pritzker took action to address the problem, including the requirement that public universities and community colleges stock free feminine hygiene products in campus bathrooms. A new report says nutrient pollution in Illinois rivers is up so high that there's no way the state can reach projected reduction in time. Juan Pablo Ramirez-Franco has the details.
The report comes from the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency and the Illinois Department of Agriculture. It shows that years of work between private and public agencies and millions of federal dollars did not result in any significant reduction to the nitrate or phosphorus being pumped into state rivers and ultimately the Mississippi River. Trevor Sample with the state's Environmental Protection Agency says that the situation is only getting more complicated.
We saw river flow increase 25%. Nitrate increased 13% and total phosphorus increased 35% compared to our baseline. And our 2025 goal is to show decreases in nitrate from 15% and total phosphorus by 25%.
The statewide push to cut nutrient pollution is part of a broader federal plan established by the U.S. EPA in 2008 to reduce the size of the hypoxic zone, which Sample characterizes as a, quote, dead zone at the mouth of the Mississippi River and the Gulf of Mexico. Hypoxic means, quote, lack of oxygen. Sample explains that the severe level of nutrient pollutants pouring out of the Mississippi River reduces the levels of oxygen in the water to the point that it hinders the ability of aquatic life to breed and thrive, making the hypoxic zone increasingly uninhabitable.
The 2008 plan originally called for the 45% reduction in nitrogen and phosphorus by 2015. By the time we got to 2015, they reconvened. We had not met the goal. In fact, it had kept getting larger for the most part. So they decided that that was probably an unrealistic timeline to begin with.
The largest hypoxic zone measured over 8,000 square miles. That was in 2017. For Illinois' part, the state set a long-term goal of reducing nutrient pollution by 45%, but it hasn't set a date on when that goal will be met. What is clear is that even an interim goal of cutting nitrate and phosphorus pollution is proving elusive. Sample says the heavier precipitation induced by climate change isn't making matters any easier.
Now looking at the water quality, how far are we or where are we positioned in terms of meeting the interim goal?
Right. So instead of seeing losses, we're actually have been seeing increases, and this is largely due to increases in precipitation.
An Illinois climate assessment released last year by the Nature Conservancy reported that precipitation patterns in Illinois are expected to become more severe. But Olivia Dorothy with American River says that climate change can't be the only answer to why the state consistently fails to meet nutrient reduction targets.
You know, we can't pin all the blame on climate change and increases in precipitation, because there's a lot of more things that farmers can be doing to keep their soil on the field and keep their nutrients in the ground where it is useful and helpful for the production of crops.
The report shows that over 80% of nitrate pollution comes from agriculture. The remaining 18% can be traced to sources like wastewater treatment facilities. Dorothy says that those treatment facilities have made significant improvements in reducing their nutrient footprint because the state steps in and regulates their operations. That differs from how agricultural production is handled, where farmers regulate themselves.
We still are seeing increases overall in the pollution problem, which really gets us to that point of like, all right, if, you know, the regulations are seem to be working on the one side, maybe that's the more effective strategy if voluntary solutions aren't cutting it.
The Rock River saw the greatest increase in nitrate pollution of any other river in Illinois, with an increase of 135% over the baseline years measured from 1980 to 1996. Katie Gregg with the Prairie Rivers Network is calling for stricter deadlines.
In the meantime, you know, we're doing so little, and then we're looking at this big goal. It's just overwhelming. And, you know, we really need to set our own interim goals. And they might not be on track currently, but we need to hold ourselves accountable.
But it will likely continue to be an uphill climb. The Illinois Department of Transportation released a report earlier this year that projected that inbound shipments of chemical fertilizers to the state will increase by 65% by 2045.
Like, do you get overwhelmed? Like, do you think, man, like, how do we, like, the trend is only going upward. We're no closer to reaching our strategy than we were before. Like, what, like, how does that freak you out? I mean, not that this is, like, you know.
I wouldn't say it's concerning. I wouldn't say it's overwhelming, but it is concerning.
Meanwhile, the Prairie Rivers Network put out a series of recommendations to improve one of the most important areas of concern when it comes to nitrates, drinking water. That includes calling for a state survey of nitrate in rural wells, digitizing well drilling records, reaching out to landowners with free testing, and updating the Illinois State Water Plan. I'm Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco.
Well, it's the end of an era in Illinois. Once the biggest retailer, Sears, is planning to close its last remaining store in the state where it opened its first large store more than a century ago. From member station WBEZ, Michael Puente has the details.
Here in Chicago, there are still a lot of reminders that Sears was once a dominant retailer. The red brick building that headquartered its vast 40-acre catalog campus on the city's west side for decades and was the home of its first store remains. But perhaps the biggest symbol sits smack dab in Chicago's downtown loop area. Today it's known as Willis Tower, but for many Chicagoans like Laura Sobranski, it's
Sears Tower, and I will always call it that.
The 108-story high-rise was once the tallest in the world. And soon, Sears won't have any large department stores left in all of Illinois. Just outside of Chicago, in the suburb of Schaumburg, sits Sears' last remaining Illinois store. Sobranski knows this store well, having grown up in the next town over.
My mom and I would go there, and then all the smells and experiences. When you first approached it, you would smell the rubber from the auto center, and then you come in, and there's the nut and candy counter.
Over the years, Sobranski continued to shop at Sears at Woodfield. Come November 14th, the doors here are closing, marking the end of a 97-year run.
Everyone shopped at Sears. It's where you bought your tools. It's where you bought your paint. The big stores, they smelled like popcorn because they sold popcorn on the main floor.
That's Gary Hoover, director of the American Business History Center. He says Richard Sears began selling watches by mail order in Minneapolis in 1886. Sears moved his company to Chicago the next year. When Robert Wood joined him years later, Sears transformed into a brick-and-mortar retailer, focusing on the entire family, not just women, like its competitor, Marshall Fields.
From the outset, those first Sears stores starting in the early to mid-1920s carried a lot of stuff for men, a lot of stuff for children, a lot of stuff for women. And the other thing is they weren't downtown. They were out where they could have a parking lot because people were just beginning to have cars.
Sears grew to some 3,000 stores, but as early as the 1970s, the company's dominance began to slide when Walmart, Target, and now, of course, Amazon boomed. In 2013, hedge fund manager Eddie Lampert took over. But within a few years, Sears filed for bankruptcy protection because it was straddled with debt topping more than $5 billion. In early 2019, Lampert and his hedge fund bought Sears out of bankruptcy, but then closed 96 stores. At last count, fewer than 40 remained. Again, Gary Hoover.
They rise and fall. And the stronger and more powerful they are, the longer it takes them to fall. It's really a part of the American fabric.
Inside Woodfield Mall, the bright blue Sears sign still shines, though much of the store is empty, with yellow and red signs reading, "Everything must go." Jim Estep, who worked here as a teenager, came to look for bargains.
It is the last store in Illinois. It used to be a flagship store, if I recall right. So it's unfortunate to see this happening to these stores.
Sears' parent company, Transform Co., plans to redevelop the Woodfield property for its real estate value. And while the Sears name isn't disappearing entirely, the days of popcorn aroma-filling department stores is quickly fading. I'm Michael Puente in Chicago.
Well, we have more to come on Statewide. We'll learn about hospice. That and more still ahead. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. It's that time of the year, farmers taking their equipment out on the road for harvest season. We'll hear from a woman who's doing her part to remind motorists to be careful. Well, up next, watching a loved one die from a terminal illness is one of the most difficult experiences to endure. Hospice is there to make it easier, but there are many misconceptions about what hospice is and isn't. Ryan Denham with WGLT in Normal spoke to two leaders of the OSF Healthcare Hospice Program, social worker Laura Baker and manager Michelle Jackson.
Jackson, who's also a nurse, says hospice is simply what happens when you've decided not to seek further treatment for a terminal illness.
Usually, the doctor thinks you have 6 months or less to live, but we have patients that do live longer with support with us going into the home frequently. We can help them live a good quality life. We're not about having things go quicker than intended. We just are there to support and provide comfort during their last days.
Laura Baker says that last part is really important.
People equate hospice with euthanasia. And so we do a lot of educating with patients and family members in the home saying, no, we don't do that. We're here to provide support, maintain, manage symptoms, keep people comfortable, give them as many good days as we can.
There are other misconceptions, like that hospice is just for patients with cancer. It's not. It's for anyone with a chronic end-stage illness. And you don't need to be imminently dying. Actually, it's better to get connected with hospice sooner so you can build a relationship with the team. And Baker says there's another one.
People think hospice is a place rather than a service that comes to you, whether that's your home in the community, whether that is in an assisted living or nursing home level of care. There is a hospice home within OSF in Peoria. So in essence, there is a place, so to speak, but hospice overall is a service. It's not a place where people go.
Your vision of hospice may be someone on their deathbed, unable to get up. That's part of it, but not all of it. Some in hospice care like getting out into the world, going out to eat. Some set a bigger goal for an out-of-state trip. Hospice is a Medicare reimbursed program, so OSF can set up a travel contract with a hospice agency in, say, Florida.
It's helping people to accomplish a goal that they maybe want to accomplish. If they want to take that last trip that they haven't been able to do. Sometimes it is celebrating a birthday, or they want to go see a wedding, you know, family member's wedding, or they're, oh golly, I just want to see the baby born. We have a patient that he wanted to still get out and about and ride on a motorcycle, you know. And so celebrating with them when they're able to meet those goals, those milestones.
As a social worker, Laura Baker works closely with the caregivers of those who are dying. Yes, it's a lot of adult sons and daughters caring for mom or dad, but they really do run the gamut more than you'd expect.
We have folks that have their own young children, and they're trying to raise their families, work, and care for mom or dad who has a condition that's come about. We are encountering grandchildren caring for grandparents. Unfortunately, we do encounter parents caring for children. Those may be infants, they may be toddlers, grade school, high schoolers, sometimes it's adult children. You also encounter, we do get folks that have, let's say, some developmental disabilities in addition to maybe whatever their diagnosis is for hospice, for example.
Hospice staff are interacting with those caregivers at one of the hardest points in their whole life.
Oftentimes our caregivers, quite frankly, are very stressed. They're overwhelmed because they have so many of their own responsibilities, and then they have the care and the concerns for their loved one. Okay, and let's just say whatever realm that falls into age category. And so it's very challenging. Many of them are trying to care for their loved one either in their loved one's own home, or the caregiver has brought them into their home. And so there are multiple challenges that come into play with that.
Hospice manager Michelle Jackson says her team is there as much for the family as they are for the patient.
We teach them how to take care of their loved one because we're not there 24/7. So we come in, we educate, and try to get them the support they need. They need paid caregivers to come into the home to help them because there are physical limitations. We try to arrange that or use community sources that are available, VA assistance if they're a veteran.
Jackson and Baker and a few dozen of their colleagues care for between 70 and 100 people at any given time who are in hospice in OSF's eastern region that includes Bloomington Normal.
This work is very difficult and hard, but it's the most rewarding thing you've ever done. So you just get that sense when you see patients and know they have a good quality of life, good passing, and family feels supported, and that recognition is what keeps you going to the next patient.
That's OSF Healthcare Hospice Program social worker Laura Baker and manager Michelle Jackson. They spoke with Ryan Denham. Some Midwest farmers are getting involved in a research project to help determine exactly how good certain practices are for the environment, especially in reducing the amount of carbon emissions going into the atmosphere. Jonathan All reports the goal is to have the data necessary to make good decisions and possibly good money in coming years.
Matt and Kate Lambert farm in north central Missouri, and they pride themselves on being good stewards of the land. Matt says they took on planting cover crops a few years ago to help maintain the soil and prevent erosion, which you can see looking out over their field of knee-high soybean plants.
And as you look out across the field, you can see the heads of the cover crop, which is cereal rye and triticale, still kind of poking up through the bean canopy from what didn't get killed or knocked down when we planted the beans.
Planting cover crops is believed to aid in carbon sequestration, or keeping carbon in the ground and out of the atmosphere. But exactly how much isn't clear. That's why the Lamberts are involved in a multi-year research project run by Missouri Corn and Missouri Soy to try to define how much they help. Kate Lambert says it's all about getting the data to know fact from speculation.
And I think that is the goal, ultimate goal of this project, is to say what's happening and what's it worth so that everybody involved in it can then make better decisions.
Derek Steen is the Director of Environmental Services with Missouri Soy. He says while the first step is to get the data, the hope is farmers can better take advantage of carbon markets where they can sell their carbon credits for the best price and know they are getting a fair deal.
I mean, there's no doubt that is important and will continue to be important, especially if growers are to be rewarded or financially or otherwise for the improvements, because you've got to have a baseline.
Steen is also quick to point out that the research isn't just about the money or the potential of it, but also to know just how friendly an environmentally friendly farming practice is. But the looming prospect of farmers selling carbon credits and getting a financial windfall has some people very concerned.
These types of carbon market schemes have had a lot of problems.
Ben Lilliston is the Director of Rural Strategies and Climate Change at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. He says attempts at operating a successful carbon credit market failed 10 to 15 years ago, largely because big polluters were looking to absolve themselves by paying a very small amount of money to people already doing the right thing. He says that problem hasn't been addressed. Even a 3 to 5 year study like the one in Missouri won't really provide useful data. Lilliston says it still may be unclear how much farming practices like no-till, cover crops, and strategic fertilizing will actually do in the long run.
Being able to measure precisely over time, and that's the key, is that when you bring in that carbon into the soil, It needs to be permanent, because if it's released, then you can't take advantage of the carbon market.
Still, the Lamberts and other farmers like them say some data is better than none. Matt Lambert says if carbon markets start up again, he wants to have as much information as he can.
And I'm afraid what's going to happen is those companies that are doing that are going to be the ones that are going to be making the big money off the carbon.
And even if the carbon markets don't come back or seem to be a bad deal for farmers, Kate Lambert says the information on carbon capture will be useful for people who have for centuries been dedicated to preserving the land that has given them their homes and livelihoods.
All of the farmers around this area that we know and work with are extremely interested in doing what's right. But it can't only be what's right for the environment. It has to also be cost efficient and time efficient and available.
And knowing how much carbon is sequestered will be an important step to answering those questions. Jonathan Aull, Harvest Public Media.
Well, farm tractors are designed to be used in the field, but sometimes farmers have to take to the highways when they need to get from one field to another. And that's when deadly problems can arise. Rich Egger tells us about a Western Illinois woman's effort to remind drivers to share the road.
On a sunny and warm late summer afternoon, Kelly Quinn of Macomb unveiled her latest piece of art. Her canvas is a vintage 1939 Farmall tractor. On the tractor is a mosaic with tiles of every color of a rainbow and more. You can see farm fields, wind turbines, and puffy white clouds in the mosaic. Quinn believes this work of art is one of a kind.
Yeah, anywhere in the world, nobody has mosaiced a tractor before. So it's a special first, and it'll be neat that it is from Macomb.
Quinn grew up in Macomb, or Macomb Baya, as she sometimes calls it. She calls the mosaic Tractor Town, and it's traveled quite a road to get here. Quinn says the tractor was a brown, crumpled heap when she found it at a salvage yard. That was a couple years ago. Since then, it's taken donations of money, materials, and time to make Tractor Town happen. And even then, the pandemic set back the project by more than a year. Why a mosaic? Why not just paint the tractor?
I typically use this material. It lasts longer than paint, and it's a little bit fresher and newer looking. It's more unique than just painting the tractor.
The mosaic tractor now stands on a stamped concrete pad that looks like a barn floor. The display is surrounded by a black wrought iron fence near the community's downtown at the intersection of two highways and a train crossing. Quinn says she wants Tractor Town to remind people that we're on shared roadways. The idea for the project came to her after a tragedy.
The image of all those tractors at the intersections really struck me.
She's referring to the funeral for Tim Sullivan. A couple years ago, the lifelong farmer was on his tractor on a stretch of highway north of Macomb when it was struck from behind by a box truck. The impact threw Sullivan from the tractor, killing him. He was 64. Accidents involving tractors kill around 250 people a year. That's according to the National Ag Safety Database. The fatalities are the result of overturns, runovers, entanglement, and highway collisions. And the database says these are by far the leading cause of death and serious injury in agriculture. As Sullivan's family left the church following the memorial service and drove to the cemetery, his youngest daughter, Teresa Young, says the family was comforted to see the route lined with tractors of all sizes and even lawnmowers as the community's farmers paid their respects.
It really made that drive after the service a memorable one and a beautiful one.
Young is one of about a dozen volunteers who helped Quinn piece together the mosaic. And on one section of the tractor, Young created a mosaic of the Sullivan family's sesquicentennial farm.
That's really a special thing for us to have and do and show our children.
Go down the Tractor Town, Mama, you won't see me no more.
After the Tractor Town dedication ceremony, Young said the family is touched by the project. She said it's personal, but also thinks the community will appreciate it.
I think it's perfect. I think the location and the outcome, the whole setup is beautiful.
Young says she's seen a lot of tractors in her day, but nothing like this. The artist, Kelly Quinn, hopes the project will get people talking about and thinking about tractors on the roads.
The talking about it is really important. If people are thinking about tractors more, maybe there'll be fewer accidents.
Quinn says she's not done reminding truck and car drivers to think about tractors while traveling through farm country. Her goal is to mosaic several more tractors and display them around Macomb. Rich Egger reporting.
That's all the time we have for Statewide. Thanks for joining us. Be with us next week. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find all of our episodes. They're available at nprillinois.org, and our podcast is also available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.